From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On the show today, both the prosecution and defense have made final arguments in Harvey Weinstein's trial. We'll tell you what the jury heard, then how the art curators at the Freeze Projects used the backdrop of Paramount Studios to their advantage.
Being on the back lot, there's so much drama. The whole allure of Hollywood, or our idea of Hollywood, in some ways is all encapsulated here. And we love the idea, you know, on the one hand, of playing into that.
And the life of a TV critic in the era of peak TV, which is shorthand for too much TV. All that coming up on The Frame. The Harvey Weinstein trial is coming to a close in New York City. After weeks of witness testimony, the prosecution and defense teams have laid out closing arguments. Next Tuesday, the jury will start deliberating whether or not to convict Weinstein of rape and other sex crimes. J. Clara Chan is a media and politics reporter at The Wrap. She's been covering the trial from Manhattan. Welcome back to The Frame.
Thanks for having me again.
So let's start with the defense's closing arguments, which were given earlier in the week. What was the message that they gave to the jury?
They were reiterating something that they had brought up in their opening, which was that all of these sexual interactions that Weinstein had with these women were consensual. And something else that Donna Rotino, who was one of the attorneys giving the closing argument, honed in on, again, were all the friendly communications between the women and Weinstein, and sort of portrayed the prosecution as trying to, working so hard or desperate to find a case against Weinstein, that they were in some way using these women. So that was sort of an extra layer that we hadn't heard before, that the prosecutions were somehow producers in their own right, trying to, you know, elevate these claims to make it seem like they amounted to rape, when Weinstein's team is saying, no, in fact, they were consensual.
The prosecution gave its closing today. So how did the DA's office portray Weinstein and the evidence that was presented earlier to the jury?
They pretty impressively weaved together the testimonies of all the women who have come forward in this trial, and sort of made the statement that Harvey Weinstein, in many ways, was this titan of Hollywood, and these women that entered his orbit somehow, or he had brought into his orbit, were disposable to him. And in many ways, that's how these relationships started. He would invite them in with promises of career development or something professional related, and very quickly the relationships or interactions would escalate from there. So they did really try to portray this picture of Weinstein as this aggressive predator, which ties into the predatory sexual assault charge that holds the most significant charge or sentence for Weinstein if he is convicted for that.
So Jonah Luzzi, one of the government's prosecutors, made this comment in court today about Harvey Weinstein. He had a surefire insurance policy. The witnesses were standing in line to get into his universe. That what this is really about, too, is about power, and that Harvey Weinstein knew that he had power over these women that would prevent them from saying what had happened to them. How much has that been a central part of the closing arguments put on by the prosecutors?
Most of the women who have testified in some ways were aspiring actresses, or in the case of Miriam Halley, she was a former production assistant. So they were all seeking entry into, as we all know, an extremely competitive industry. And something that she referenced that he would do is, you know, after the alleged incidents happened, he would in some way still have contact with them so that they were aware of his power and they were aware of the reach that he had. Something that they had brought up during their closing arguments were emails, you know, showing that the Weinstein Company had set up meetings with these women to sort of talk about scripts or to talk about an audition for something that, in the prosecution's eyes, were not really legitimate meetings. They were just sort of ruses for Weinstein to make sure these women knew how powerful he was in the industry.
We're talking with J. Clara Chan at The Wrap about the closing arguments in the Harvey Weinstein trial. The judge in the case will give the jury instructions and send them into deliberations on Tuesday of next week. You have been talking with legal experts who've been watching the trial. How do they assess the evidence that the prosecution has put on and the defense that Harvey Weinstein's lawyers have offered up so far?
It does seem like a really mixed bag. It could really go one way or the other. I don't think this is an obvious Slam dunk was one phrase one lawyer used with me, but it's not an obvious case because there are very nuanced issues at play here, and there are five different charges that the jury will have to deliberate over. So if there is at the very least one person who has a sliver of doubt and feels that they cannot convict, then you could have a hung jury, and that could lead to a mistrial. So that's very much a possibility here.
It sounds as if Harvey Weinstein's defense team is saying this case should not be a referendum on the Me Too movement. But ultimately, it is, regardless of what happens, you know, conviction or acquittal, that I don't think it's possible to not see this trial as a referendum on the movement. Do you?
I would agree with that sentiment. I mean, it's already very rare or very difficult for cases involving sexual assault and rape to even make it to the trial stage. And on top of that, we're talking about the Harvey Weinstein trial, and he was, you know, one of the biggest figures in the rise of the Me Too movement when it comes to like thinking about power imbalances and the abuse of a lot of women. So, I mean, however this trial turns out, whether there's a conviction or acquittal, it is historic, and it does mean something in the greater picture of how this movement is developing over time.
Harvey Weinstein's defense team has made a number of objections through the trial and before it, kind of arguing about evidence and some procedural issues. But let's look at the actual potential punishment. If Harvey Weinstein is convicted of the most serious crimes in this case, he is facing, isn't he, the possibility of life behind bars?
Yes, that's correct.
But there are other circumstances where he might be convicted on some charges, acquitted on others, where the range could be complete acquittal to maybe, you know, even just a couple of months in jail.
I believe for some of the rape charges or the forcible sexual act charge, I believe it's capped at 25 years. But again, it could be a range. It all depends on how the jury decides and how sentencing rolls out.
Right. And that might be the statute, but the judge has discretion within those statutes. J. Clara Chan is a media and politics reporter at The Wrap. She joined us from New York, where the Harvey Weinstein trial is coming to a close. Jury deliberations are scheduled to begin on Tuesday. Clara, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me again.
Coming up next on The Frame, we visit the Paramount Pictures studio lot, not for a movie, but for an art show. Freeze Los Angeles is an international art fair with dozens of booths from galleries around the globe. The fair also includes Freeze Projects, which is staged on the Paramount Studios backlot. It features installations by 16 artists that contend with issues of representation, particularly when it comes to Hollywood stereotypes. I toured the site with curators Rita Gonzalez and Pilar Tompkins-Rivas, and we began at the Paramount Studios fountain, where a bronze mountain lion sat perched on a laundry machine. Here's Pilar Tompkins-Rivas.
This is a sculpture by the artist Will Boone, and this is actually an homage to P22, which is the mountain lion, the very famous LA mountain lion who's survived the elements of the urban environment. And this is one of three sculptures that Will has here as part of Freeze in the backlot.
So this might be one of the first pieces that visitors would see.
Right.
Tell us why you placed it here and why this is maybe the first thing that people encounter.
We're thinking, I mean, it's tough because being on the backlot, there's so much drama. The whole allure of Hollywood or our idea of Hollywood, in some ways, is all encapsulated here on the backdrop. And we kind of were allowed to do that with Will Boone and placing this piece right in front of the beautiful, gushing, you know, Paramount fountain.
So in a way, you're kind of taking over this lot to promote the things that you think need paying attention to.
Yeah, and art fairs typically, or, you know, of last decade and a half, as they've really emerged globally, they typically take place in convention centers. They're adjacent to the business corridor. This is a bit different. And the opportunity to be on Paramount Studios kind of opens up other opportunities for us so that we're not just dialoguing with the art market. We actually get to be on a studio backlot where films are produced it is another aspect that's equally important in Los Angeles.
So I'm going to grab my tea. Tell us where we're going next.
So let's head over to the simulation of New York and a little bit of Chicago.
Chicago the city or Chicago the musical? I just want to make sure since we're on the
city.
Paramount lot. As we're walking through the lot, I'm going to ask you also about, you know, how pop culture and movies and TV shows and films that are produced on this lot, how they connote certain ways of thinking about the world, and whether or not you see part of your work here as an alternative narrative, because we have a long history of Hollywood not being totally inclusive and sending very narrow messages about who is and is not worth being heard and seen.
Well, I mean, this is a really interesting opportunity to think about the complexity of all of those issues. We immediately thought of, you know, the artist Vincent Ramos when we were invited to do this project. Vincent is an artist who's been dealing with issues of representation in the film and television industry and Hollywood in general throughout his career, and thinking about the different forms in which specifically Mexican-American and Chicano culture has been portrayed throughout different decades. And the installation that he's producing for part of the Freeze Project deals exactly with that.
When I think about art fairs, things like Art Basel in Miami, having been there, there's a very narrow slice of the world that's attending, and it's very moneyed and largely really white. So how do you go about making sure that the people who are coming represent a spectrum of LA broadly, demographically, on income levels, however you want to define it?
Well, you know, I think access will always be an issue because it is a ticketed event, but you can come here and not go to the fair. You can come and have a separate ticket that's, you know, a bit more affordable and just go onto the back lot and see the projects.
Are we turning right? Right onto the back
turning
lot.
Right.
Well, you know, one of the ways is by thinking more inclusively in terms of artist representation and whose voices are being showcased within this context. You know, and we're about to approach, as we come onto the back lot, Gabriela Sanchez, who is one of our commissioned artists for Freeze. And this is an artist whose images not only are presented in the context of galleries and institutions, but on social media. And so her reach and presence, especially in this day and age, the way that artists work with digital platforms, it helps to also broaden the conversation. And knowing that these rarefied spaces are not the only ways that people can engage with artist imagery.
We're talking with Rita Gonzalez and Pilar Tompkins-Rivas on the Paramount Backlot about Freeze projects. So this is the Paramount Backlot, and we're on what I guess would pass for some sort of street scene, and you've got fronts of buildings. Yeah, there's usually nothing behind them because we don't go in them.
Right.
But you've taken them over.
Yeah, so we have three installations in the brownstones. So Channing Hansen is an artist who works with weaving and knitting, and he has created this knitted environment in the brownstone, loosely inspired by an episode of Star Trek.
Can we look in?
Yes, yes. I think Channing might be there.
Channing, would you be agreeable to being on KPCC with John Hart?
I don't remember. I came to the studios 5 years ago.
Yeah,
John Hart from KPCC.
So we've stepped off the back lot. We're inside a brownstone. There's a lot of string and yarn in here. So how do the archives inspire what we're seeing being installed here?
Oh, well, I'm a big fan of Star Trek, and the original series was actually filmed on this very street, some episodes, and their production lot was here. And so I got to go through their archives, and I focused in on their episode, The Tholian Web.
We see it, but our sensors indicate it is not there.
Which this netting is based upon that episode. And I'm stretching the knitted works over it. And so it's like you can kind of think of it as like a mile of string meets the Tholian web.
So For people who don't remember that episode, what happens in that episode?
Captain Kirk is caught in interphase between two worlds, and as they have to rescue him before this net is encases the Enterprise and destroys them all.
I think he survived.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
That was perfect. Thanks so much.
Well, could we talk a little bit about Tanya's piece? Yeah.
Sure. We have another artist who's here, Tanya Candiani.
Hi, I'm John.
Yeah, I'm going to just ask you some questions about, tell us your name and what your piece is called.
Yeah, my name is Tanya Candiani, and my piece is called Camouflage.
So I see the beginnings of the installation, some netting. What inspired it? How did it come together?
Well, this is based in a photo I found from Dorothea Lange, that she was documenting the camps where the Japanese were captured during the Second World War. And they were detention camps where Japanese were, all the people that were there, they were forced to work in the camps. And the photo is a group of ladies weaving these nets, which are for camouflage, bringing into the memory that labor work and creating connection of what is happening now in the border with the detention camps for the migrants.
So these women were making camouflage to be used in the war, even as they and their families were detained because they were of Japanese ancestry.
Yes, basically is that the terrible story. So I believe that bringing that story to the present will help us to rethink about that and try to change the story. And hopefully it's going to be a piece about memory and how can we talk about this history and hopefully not repeat it.
I only have a couple more questions, but I see some people around a cauldron that I think we have to maybe make our last stop. So what is this piece? It looks like three, are they brujas? What are we seeing
here?
They're
witches, yes.
Three brujas around a cauldron.
This is another piece by Will Boone that also greets visitors just as soon as they enter the back lot. And like the P-22 piece that is at the very front entrance, these are bronze sculptures that have been painted with enamel paint, but they're based on the toy figurines that were sold in kits after World War II, and many of them have reference to different periods of sci-fi Hollywood, you know, motion pictures and kind of the post-World War II era. And so he's taken those figurines and then done 3D renderings of them and then scaled them up to be, in this case, they're not life-size witches, but they're something akin to that.
And we should say the cauldron has some eyeballs, a snake, looks like a
cat,
and about to go into it is a rabbit, a bat, and maybe some sort
of tonic,
beer or tonic or some sort of beverage. I mean, you have artists who are looking through the archives, but what kind of connections do you hope are made between what Paramount represents, what Hollywood represents, what the archives might hold, and what artists are inspired to do?
The spectrum here is pretty broad, and I think, you know, from an aspect of being a fan, you know, an artist is sort of a fan and extrapolating that, you know, on the one hand, to we talked to Tanya, her interest in bringing out a more kind of geopolitical statement in her work, to Patrice Cullors, who will be doing a dance performance over the course of the weekend and also trying to highlight her activism in prison reform. So, you know, it's like a whole range of cultural politics, I think, back here.
Rita and Pilar, thanks so much for showing us around the Paramount lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been great.
The Freeze Art Fair continues over the weekend at Paramount Pictures. Up next on The Frame, the lament of the TV critic in the era of too much TV. TV viewers today have more options than ever before. And while that might be a godsend to couch potatoes everywhere, For TV critics, it's been a mixed blessing. The Frame contributor Colin Friesen attended the recent Television Critics Association gathering to check in on how the professionals are coping in the era of peak TV.
I watched the terrible thing, so you don't have to.
That's Sarah Rodman, the head of the Television Critics Association. Currently a features editor at Entertainment Weekly, she's been coming to these events for the last 16 years. And although the critics now get episode screeners in advance, Rodman says this year set a record with more than 679 scripted shows vying for their attention.
That's a crazy number. How do you get through it as a TV critic?
You don't, is the short answer. Because nobody can watch 679 TV shows.
Those chimes mean it's time for yet another session at the posh Langham Hotel in Pasadena. This is the epicenter of TV criticism, where twice a year, networks and streaming services trot out the casts and creators of their shows for some free media exposure. On this day, CBS hit a high note with its Star Trek reboot, Picard, starring Patrick Stewart.
All that emptiness.
According to Rodman, the ever-increasing number of shows to watch, and thus workload for the critics, has changed the way many members approach their work.
With the proliferation of shows and platforms, that a lot of people have tended more towards, we want to celebrate the things that are good instead of wasting column space on things that are bad.
So does that mean television critics have become even more vital during this era of peak TV? Well, sort of.
But I will say that it is both more and less important. The more that there are shows, the more people can make their own decision. Like, some people are like, I'm just going to browse through everything and make up my own mind. I don't care what critics say, but that's probably always been true for that viewer. So I think that if there are a ton of shows, there definitely are people that are looking for somebody to say, keep me from drowning.
What I think the TV critic today is most important for is curation. We can tell you what's good. We can tell you what is quality. We can tell you what's bad. But people, water seeks its own level.
That's Damian Holbrook, who writes for TV Guide magazine. Holbrook, along with fellow reviewer Rick Bentley, sat down between sessions to explain how critics can draw people to some shows that might have otherwise been overlooked.
And I think it's our responsibility to be the guys who find, men and women who find those shows that are worth seeing, mm-hmm. and promote, you know, like, I don't know if somebody would have found Fleabag,
right,
had we not been trumpeting it. Mm-hmm.
People didn't find their way to Schitt's Creek until its fourth season. And we had been championing it for years, but nobody was looking at it because it was on a smaller network. Some cable stations weren't even carrying pop TV, but we were talking so much about it and praising it so much that people then started to find it on Netflix.
Dana Calvo, who created the show Good Girls Revolt for Amazon, is a former reporter who's been up on that stage at the TV Critics Association get-together.
You know, it's a little strange for me. I'm facing people that I've worked with before.
She agrees that TV critics generally don't have the power to kill a show and can help find an audience for overlooked programs. But she adds sometimes reviewers can do even more than that.
And sometimes, you know, with streaming, you get the pilot to come out, and then 8 months later, you have the rest of the series launch. Some of the opinions of the pilot we heard and took note of.
With only so many people wanting to read about TV, everyone points to social media and the rise of TV bloggers and tweeters as a major disruption to the status quo. But TCA President Rodman maintains professional critics aren't going away anytime soon.
This isn't purely promotion for most of the people who are here, but it's still the best bang for their buck that they're getting 200 some odd voices all at once talking about their show for good or for ill. The sort of massive impact of it is still true. That aspect of it hasn't gone away.
It might be tempting to look at the decline of newspapers and magazines and see a time when events like this don't make financial sense for broadcasters and streamers. But who would have predicted the rise of podcasters taking deep dives into their favorite shows? So while events like this certainly aren't cheap, for now at least, the show, make that the shows, will definitely go on. And on, and... For The Frame, I'm Colin Friesen.
Hey And that is all for today. Remember, you can tune in to The Frame Weekend Saturday afternoon at 2, and you'll learn which other South Korean filmmakers you should check out, in addition to Oscar winner Bong Joon-ho. The show is produced by Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin, with help this week from Itzy Quintanilla. Eduardo Perez is our engineer. The Frame's theme music, which you're hearing now, is by Taylor McFerrin, and the show's senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn. We're off on President's Day, but back here Tuesday from the Moon Broadcast Center. Have a great holiday weekend.